Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Are you interested in hearing about body image in a traditional culture before and after exposure to television? Well, joining us today to talk to us about it is Anne Becker, MD, PhD, Dean for Clinical and Academic Affairs, Professor of Psychiatry, and Presley Professor of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. A medical anthropologist and psychiatrist, Dr. Becker's research includes the social and cultural mediation of presentation and risk for eating disorders and social barriers to care for mental disorders. Dr. Becker is founding and past Director of the Eating Disorders Clinical and Research Program at Mass General Hospital, past President of the Academy of Eating Disorders, former Associate Editor of the International Journal of Eating Disorders, and was a member of the DSM-5 Eating Disorders Work Group. She has been recognized as a recipient of NIDA's Price Family Award for Research Excellence, as well as the Academy for Eating Disorders Leadership Award in Research. Dr. Becker, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Dr. Becker, I have a funny story that has to do with you. Is it all right if I start with that?
Yes, I'm very curious.
Okay, good. So I'm going to say about 15 years ago, I was at an international eating disorder conference, and at this point, I don't even remember where it was. And before attending the conference, I had listened to the CD of your groundbreaking Fiji Island study that we're going to talk about today. I had listened to the CD more times than I care to mention, Dr. Becker. And anyway, I'm at this international conference. I'm sitting there. I'm getting ready for the keynote speaker, and someone to the right of me speaks to me. I hear her voice. I recognize it from the CD, and it's you.
Well, first of all, I hope I was nice.
Oh, you were so nice.
Well, and here we are again with my voice
right.
About to be
exactly
voice.
Yeah. So at that time, I could not have imagined that we would be here today, and I was hoping that you could tell our listeners about that Fiji Island study.
Well. Absolutely. I would love to talk about that study. But before I do, I should probably point out it's actually a series of studies. And I will go back to the very beginning, which is actually almost, you know, if you're going to think of time zero as being the publication of the study you're referring to, it's actually, you know, T minus several years. Because I started to work in this community in Fiji, which is the Itaukei community of Fiji. I started to work there as an undergraduate and then a graduate student. And I will tell you, I was a student of anthropology both times. And I started off with a very different set of interests. And actually, I was interested in how women in this community organize themselves as a collective to ensure that everybody in the community had the food they needed to eat to feed their families. And so the women did all of the fishing. They did a lot of the farming. And I wanted to study this. So I went there in actually the 1980s. I think it was 1982 when I first went there. And you know, I was there as an observer, and my hosts were incredibly generous and just sharing their stories and perspectives. And as I left after about a summer of staying there, I couldn't shake this feeling that there was just something different about the way that women occupied their bodies, and also very different about the way that that bodies were very much part of the public space. So there was a lot of commentary about my body, which as an American, you know, college student was for me deeply unfamiliar and uncomfortable, I will admit. But I was also just really intrigued by how comfortably women talked about their bodies, other bodies, and I wanted to learn more. So I went back as a graduate student in anthropology again to do my dissertation. But before I went, I made a trip back to ask permission of this community for my presence there for, a year or more. They are just such extraordinary hosts, but they immediately said, yes, of course. Now, what is it that you want to study? And I started to articulate this sort of comparative framework that I had in mind, which is that they were so comfortable about their bodies and also very different around what aesthetic ideals they identified, and that they were talking about these ideals quite a bit. And in fact, so much that it was a bit startling to me as an American. And I told them I was really interested in understanding that better. And they listened, patiently nodding. And they said, look, you can come back, you can stay with us, we're happy to have you, but what you're describing, that's not a thing. We don't feel like we talk about our bodies much, and we really don't see it the way you do, but maybe you'll learn more when you come. So I start with that story because I think it's important. Sometimes people ask, what is the relevance of what happens in Fiji, which is 10,000 miles away from where I sit right now? What's the relevance of what happens there to how we understand experience here or anywhere in the world? And in this particular example, you can see that body experience is not necessarily something we can presume is universal. Mm. And more importantly, I think it's pretty easy, even back in the 1980s, it was easy to see that there were certain cultural communities that were kind of outliers. If you think about global culture then, and thinness being, identified fairly in a very widespread way as a cultural ideal, there were a couple of areas of the world where that just wasn't the case, and the cultural ideal was a more robust, filled out body. But even starting off with, okay, fine, we'll accept the premise that the aesthetic ideals that are identified are, sort of what is salient in the local context. The premise that I started with, which was that people related in a particular way to these aesthetic ideals in terms of motivation, in terms of desire to cultivate the body, to present the body in a way that conformed to this ideal. That was a flawed premise. And that's what I didn't understand this for quite a while into my ethnographic work in Fiji, but it finally got through to me that it didn't matter that individuals in Fiji identified a different aesthetic ideal, that they had the experience of identifying it and saying, yes, that's beautiful, but not necessarily feeling that sense of I need to be that way or I won't feel okay about myself. And they would simply shrug and point out that this is the way they were made and that they didn't really feel, in Fiji, the experience of body is very much that the body is located in social space, in family space. And you are not necessarily, and look, you can argue both ways, is it necessarily a good thing not to feel empowered over how you present your body? Many would argue, well, people should always be empowered. But on the other hand, this sense of, well, it's not really my choice how to present myself, how to dress in this case, and back then, how they should cut their hair and how they should conduct themselves, etc. They sort of felt like, look, these aren't decisions that I make, so I don't spend a lot of time feeling frustrated that I don't measure up and feeling judged because I don't measure up. So this was, predated the study that you read at that time. And the reason I mentioned it is that really set the stage for me to wonder, well, what is it about this particular community that is has been so wonderfully resilient against disordered eating. And by the way, at the time, you know, again, back in the 1980s, that was before I was trained as a psychiatrist. But of course, I was interested already in how did body experience in Fiji translate into maybe a certain level of well-being and resilience against some of the, you know, pathologies we see associated with eating disorders. So I was very curious about, you know, was this way of experiencing the body protective against mm-hmm. eating disorders? And I will tell you that that I, you know, at the time, I was a medical student, so I had quite a bit of interface with the local district hospital, where, you know, they were also very generous in hosting me. And my host in the village, she eventually became the chief. She was a trained health professional. She was a midwife. And nobody could tell me about anyone in their community who had had an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they were incredulous when I described what an eating disorder was, saying things like, well, how could that even be? And what's going on with the family that they're not fixing this? And finally saying, you know, half jokingly, half serious, look, you know, if there are people who are struggling with this, send them to us and we will help them recover to eat again. And, you know, so I wanted to dig a little further than that. So there were, you know, remember, this is Fiji was at that time a lower middle income country, very few health resources. There were at most one or two psychiatrists in the country. They certainly weren't in the community or near the community where I was working. But I did go there to ask, so is there any, you know, sense of prevalence of disordered eating, eating disorders, case records? And I was told, you know, they could recall a case maybe once of a very emaciated person, could have been anorexia, you know, hard to know. But in all my conversations, what got established was that there was no category in the indigenous indigenous nosology, meaning the diseases and disorders and conditions that make sense and are salient locally. There were no categories that mapped onto anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, nothing like that. And so it's not that they couldn't understand that somebody maybe had nutritional issues, needed to be refed, or maybe lost their appetite. They just didn't have a category for eating disorders. And what I was describing as eating disorders were completely unfamiliar. So, but there was a caveat to that, which is this. There is a condition called mavake, that's the local word for it. I believe there's a similar condition in many of the Pacific Islands. They probably all have different names. Mavake is appetite loss, but it is not similar in other ways to anorexia nervosa or ARFID, as far as I can see. So mavake is a condition that's usually a pediatric condition. It's benign, it's transient. It does not map onto any other diseases, you know, that we're familiar with. And the etiology, the explanatory model for that illness, is that a child maybe has been eating, you know, junk food or hasn't been eating well. And there's a lot of community vigilance for children who are losing weight or not eating well. And there's immediate intervention, you know, not just the parent. It's sort of like, we need to feed this child so that this child is reestablishing good nutritional habits. So there's a lot of interest in a robust appetite, a healthy appetite, and there's a lot of community surveillance for children who are not eating well. And there's even a step further where occasionally there's a perception that a child or an adult has really lost weight. But the assumption is that that tracks with social neglect and that somebody has lost weight. the community needs to rally to re-engage them. And, you know, and again, you know, I don't know, they do have a term for it, a luchu haranga e ilala. But, you know, could it be something similar to anorexia of depression? Maybe, maybe. But again, this is something that the community identifies as a problem that has to do with the social milieu. Are people caring for their community members the way they should be? And so that's a long digression into madake, but I did want to mention it because it illustrates that it's not that this community didn't care about or think about eating and appetite and weight. They thought about it a lot. It's just that it didn't get configured in the way that we know of as an eating disorder. So now let's fast forward. It's 1995. Mm-hmm. I'm back in this community. And actually, I'm doing a completely different project this time. I'm looking at postnatal depression. And that's a story for another day. But while I was there, I was reading the newspaper and I learned that the Fijian government, who regulated, I guess, broadcast television in some way, had decided that after many years of not allowing broadcast television to be routinely available and accessible in the, you know, rural communities or, you know, anywhere but the hotels, they had decided that they were going to allow it. So so I started to think, wow, you know, here you have a community that's literally never been exposed to television as we know it. Of course, television as we know it, or we knew it in 1995, is pretty different from the way it is in 2023. Right. But I think we all know, you know, this is, we're talking about having TV shows that are, you know, where there's content that is, you may have one or two channels, but there's content that follows things like news, entertainment, sports, and it's serialized, et cetera. So that sort of thing just hadn't been available in Fiji before. But what was interesting was that there were, of course, there were, well, not of course, but there were films available in Fiji. So there were cinemas and movie theaters, et cetera. So it's not that people hadn't seen, you know, moving pictures. And there also were, in very affluent households, there was equipment to play recorded films. So, you know, in the day, it's called VCR. And so it was a little bit of a paradox, right? Because they may have had a television set in one of the households in the whole village, but not necessarily TV. And they would, you know, rent a movie and bring it back. And, you know, in the case that I observed, this was in the Chifley household. And, you know, somebody had gone overseas to work as a seasonal laborer, I think, and had, you know, wanted to bring a gift back to the chief. And the chief had purchased this VCR and TV. And so it was sitting there ready to go when TV arrived. Now, let me just say something about when TV arrived. It's important observation because the experience of, you know, well, I'll tell you a story. So in 1986, right before I went back for my ethnographic work, I came for, you know, a short trip just to make sure that everybody knew what my plans were and, you know, make sure everyone was comfortable with those. And I arrived, you know, when this is in the days, you don't have email or anything. So I arrived, you know, I don't know if they were expecting me or not, but I arrived, it's a dusty ride. And they said, oh, you know, Anne, good to see you here. Look, you look very tired. You probably are. Why don't you go take a nap? And when you wake up, you can let us know what movie you would like us to rent. And I, you know, I was not expecting that. And why? Because when I had been there earlier for my earlier work, there hadn't been electricity in the village. Oh. So you're in a situation, I'm like, what, you know, what now? You have not only electricity, but movies to rent. So, you know, I woke up and the whole community gathered and everybody's kind of you know, squished in to communally view a movie. I don't remember which one it was, on a tiny TV set. But what was interesting about that was the movies that were selected. I didn't weigh in on which movie to watch. I was very interested in what movie they would want to watch. But the movies that were selected were, because there weren't a lot of English-speaking adults, the movies generally had to have a lot of action and a lot of, you know, car crashes and spectacular dancing or whatever it was. And so you didn't really need to know what the plot was, or the plot was, you know, pretty self-evident. So I set that up because, of course, that's very, very different from what people would experience in following a TV show, especially a drama or a soap opera or even a comedy series. You know, where you get to know the characters and you do want to follow the plot, which might be more nuanced. So when television finally arrived, many of the households had electricity, or they had selective electricity, and many of them had equipment so that they could immediately, like the moment it arrived, it wasn't, you know, as though people had to wait and save up money and go buy equipment. They were ready to go. So television arrived just like it was being dropped in, parachuting in from nowhere. And this was in 1995. And as I mentioned, and so I was already working on a project, and I thought, gosh, you know, this is really going to be, I think, disruptive or not. And if it's not disruptive, boy, can we learn a lot, you know, from our Fijian colleagues. So I had some time before television was arriving to put together a very, very simple study and, you know, arrange for all the complicated things you have to arrange when you're doing research like this. But what we thought we would do is take advantage of what, you know, turned out to be a natural experiment, which was that we had a, you know, a community that was essentially unexposed to television per se, and they were about to be exposed. So we could sort of a classic pre-post design. And that's what we did. And it's important to say that in the mid-1990s, I think Fiji was one of the last places on the planet that didn't have TV yet. So there were very few opportunities to this, you know, sort of unfolding of this phenomenon. And we thought it was important to do for that reason. And also, you know, again, my hypothesis was that nothing would change because of the, you know, all of the cultural protections that I was aware of that really mitigated risk for disordered eating. But I really wanted to learn from that. And at the time, there were studies about media exposure and eating disorders risk. But those studies were really challenging, very difficult to draw causal inference from cross-sectional studies, right? Because as you know, people who are more predisposed to an eating disorder might choose to consume more media, or, you know, there could be other factors. Plus, in the U.S., there's, you know, nearly what we would call saturation of televisions and households. Right? So everybody's got a TV, everybody's got access. So not only is it difficult, you know, you can kind of look at individual exposure and outcome, but even then it's difficult to control for what other factors might confound whether or not somebody has individual exposure. But it's also impossible to look at what I came to think of as secondhand impacts of media, you know, sort of like you think of secondhand smoke from smokers being dangerous, even though they've been smoking themselves. So in this case, this unfolding, very dynamic situation gave us an opportunity to at least try to understand what would go on. So that's when my hosts and the communities were extremely generous with their time and with their collaboration. And what we did was we thought, okay, we will, there are a couple of schools in this area. These are secondary schools, high schools. And what we'll do is we'll just kind of get a cross-sectional view of what's going on with these Fijian schoolgirls of a certain age and, you know, pre-exposure or right as exposure is happening for the first time. And then we'll check it again. And you know, that's what we would call a two-wave cross-sectional design. It's not perfect, but it was the, you know, what we could do in that short amount of time. And, but here's another problem. As I've already told you, nobody is familiar with eating disorders and eating pathology in the setting. And we were working with standardized assessments that work very well, you know, in the communities they were developed for, like the U.S. But how did we know that people would really understand words like calories or pitching or purging? In fact, we were pretty sure that we couldn't count on that. So, but it was what we had. And I will say in this particular study, the schools, the formal language of instruction was English. So we decided
it was.
But let me get back to that. Put a pin in that because that is a huge flaw in the study. We were able to fix that later in a subsequent study. But what we were worried about was that a paper and pencil screening test was just that. It's just a screen, right? It isn't really going to tell us, you know, who's got what and what does it mean here locally and how do people understand the questions. So we wanted to use first of all, we wanted it to be a mixed method study. We wanted to use a survey. It was at the time, it was the EAT26 that we used, but we wanted to then interview individuals who endorse certain symptoms. And one of the, it's complicated and lots to describe, but let me zero in on the indicator that we thought was probably the best one to demonstrate that what was being reported was actually eating pathology. And that was purging or vomiting in order to lose weight, because it doesn't matter, you know, wherever you are in the world, if that's going on, there are going to be medical consequences potentially. So we did not want to pathologize something that would be seen as normative behavior in Fiji. And because, you know, the way people consume food is different, all kinds of things are different. We wanted to be extremely conservative in what we called indicators of pathology. So in this case, I think our strongest indicator was when an individual ticked the box that said, yes, she had vomited to control her weight. We only accepted that as a positive if we could interview her face to face. And this is with my colleague who was Fijian and could speak in her language if necessary. We wanted to be sure that she understood what she was describing as a symptom and that it mapped on to what we understood as purging. So that was our very conservative bar. And that's how I have confidence that this is a real signal. So so in that first, you know, 1995 cohort, in terms of using that bar, who was purging to lose weight, no one, not a single student was doing that. And that was,
and in 1995, they were just starting to get the television exposure.
Yes. So 1995, it was literally, we were working as fast as we could. And TV was kind of, if you imagine lights turning on and kind of blinking on, TV was just coming online. So we were getting to these students right around the time as this was all happening. So kind of, you know, if they had seen TV, they may have seen it, but they hadn't seen it for more than, I don't know.
Oh, I see. I follow.
So that was good, right? Glad to confirm that there wasn't any purging going on. But then when we returned, you know, how long is long enough? I don't know. No one has an answer for that. We happened to be able to go back and the village could receive us in 1998. So we thought, well, that's a good amount of time to see if this is really permeating how young women are experiencing their bodies and how they're approaching food and diet. So we went back then and we did, you know, essentially, so remember, these are different students. but they're at the same schools and the same communities, the same ages, same grades. So again, they're kind of matched in terms of characteristics. And we use that indicator again. And in 1998, instead of 0% or zero, we had 11.3% of the young women endorse this. Interview confirmed that they were, that they had purged to manage their weight. Now, that's what we call, obviously, a, you know, it's more of an ecological study, right? Because we, you know, how do we know which risk factor it was? I mean, lots is going on in Fiji. The economy is transitioning. Electricity is more available. So, so many different things are happening. And, you know, one of the exposures is TV and TV. And it's a stretch to say, well, we know it's TV. And the other problem or question is, well, is there a dose effect, right? Because we're not sort of mapping who's symptomatic onto who's watched how much TV. We're just kind of looking at a community that's more or less unexposed and then exposed and what happened in that time. And we interviewed people.
Okay. Wait, so what's a dose effect?
Oh, sorry. Dose effect isn't really the right term, I guess, that I should have used, but it's, I'm thinking of television exposure as a dose of like toxin, if you will, for a better word. And what we didn't, so in other words, does it matter how much TV you're exposed to, like how many hours a day or which programs or how many years or months or whatever? We didn't really have a way to unpack that.
Okay. I have a question. So in this time, 1995 to 98, was Fiji still a subsistence agriculture? Nothing had changed in that way.
So Sigma, that is such a good question. And I'm going to give you not a yes, no answer.
Okay.
Because I can't. It's much more nuanced. And what I will say is that it was transitioning, and it has transitioned, you know, really over the course of decades from a subsistence agriculture society, which is what I was studying in 1982 when I was interested.
Yes.
You know, how are these women feeding the village? And it was transitioning throughout that time to a cash-based economy, but it wasn't all at once. So there were some, you know, and it kind of depended where you were. So there were, you know, most people didn't have wage-earning jobs, but more and more part of the agricultural, efforts would be devoted to cash crops like sugar cane or selling foods in the market. So things were transitioning, but it is important to know that traditionally, Fiji is a subsistence agriculture society.
And Dr. Becker, I should probably ask you, how are you defining a subsistence agriculture?
Well, yeah. So in this case, I think the easiest way to think of it is that you are, you as a family, as a community, are basically living off the land, if you will. So you are responsible for cultivating all of your plant-based protein and plant-based food and finding whatever protein you can. And the protein in this case would generally be from the, you know, aquatic species in the river and the ocean. And the idea is that you are not dependent on a market economy where you're needing, you know, you don't have the time or land to farm. And so you need to, you know, have something to, some currency to buy your food. Now, of course, there have been stores in Fiji for many years and it, you know, it's been, you know, it had been colonized by the British and, you know, there's a gradual transition to the British way of doing things. And that's another story. But the idea is that there are many families in Fiji who don't need to participate in a wage economy because they have their community-based land and they can do just fine and meet their needs, not having to rely on store-bought food or, you know, in many cases, people do go to the market, which is where there's you know, locally grown food, of course. But the subsistence agricultural economy is important here because right around the time that Fiji was getting electricity and exposure to television, the economy was transitioning more and more toward wage-based. And so individuals who were coming of age in the 1990s, who were also, you know, sort of the age cohort of the study, were more and more feeling pressure to get a job when they graduated from secondary school. In fact, it wasn't just, you know, self-imposed pressure. I mean, their parents were saying, you know, really need a job. And really interestingly, a lot of these young women had parents who had never had a job. I mean, they didn't need a job, right? So they were working on their own farms or, you know, taking care of animals or going fishing. And so the young women didn't have role models for getting into the cash economy. So, and so this is where TV comes in, and this is where the interviews were so illuminating, because when we sat down to talk to the you know, participants in the study in 1998, and we talked to, you know, we didn't just talk, we were purposefully sampling people because we wanted to find out, you know, even people who weren't reporting symptoms, we wanted to find out how are they integrating TV into their lived experience. And it was astonishing that so many of these women talked about watching the actresses on TV and seeing their degree of, you know, and I'm doing air quotes here, success in a wage economy, and thinking, okay, how are they doing it? How, you know, what lessons can I learn from these young people? And I'm sure that most of your listeners are too young to remember a couple of the television shows that were very popular at that time, but they were syndicated already in the US. So Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place are two of those shows. And Beverly Hills 90210 was remarkable for the fact that, first of all, it's a very affluent community, but the main characters were about the same age as the respondents in the study, and they had jobs. I don't know if you remember, but two of the main characters, some of them worked in the Peach Pit, which was, I don't know, some kind of restaurant.
I remember. I haven't thought of it in that long, but yes, I remember the Peach Pit.
Right. So, I mean, you know, what maybe American viewers would, it would have just, you know, been not in an extraordinary detail at all, but the Fijian viewers were looking at this as, wow, these are teenagers who have jobs, and wow, they have cars. They have nice things. And this is really, really interesting to us. So we had a situation where many, so you could see from the qualitative data, the interview data, we could learn a lot more about how these teenagers were interacting with these television shows. It also seemed to be that there was something really, you know, between movies that was sort of a one-shot deal and you didn't build a relationship with the character or identify with the character, that there was a transformation in how people felt about television characters, because they would follow along in a soap opera. And, you know, and it's interesting because I know the study findings suggested that eating pathology started to get a foothold in Fiji at that time. And that is true. And you know, a very significant percentage of the respondents said, well, I'm watching these characters and they're thin and I feel like that's the ticket. And, you know, I'm going to copy them and do what they do. And and they also noticed, P.S., that everyone was thin. I mean, it, right. You know, you heard TV back then, everybody looked the same. But I think it's important to note that they didn't, you know, they also chose characters who were strong. So there's a New Zealand show, I believe it's called Xena Warrior Princess. Mm-hmm. And the protagonist is really strong looking. She's tall and muscular, and they loved that character. They would like, I want to be like Xena.
I remembered Xena having something to do with this, but this really brings it full circle for me.
Right. And you know, in some ways that was heartening to me, right? Because mm-hmm. Zena, I mean, I didn't really watch the show, but she was a good role model in certain mm-hmm. ways. But, you know, the other thing, Signa, that was striking to me is that the young people said that they felt like they could get advice, or, you know, that they could use some of what they learned on TV as guidance. And they, you know, I think the extreme example of this that's really telling is that they watched X-Files, right? X-Files, which is sci-fi. They said, yeah, you know, I can really learn a lot from X-Files. And I remember thinking, but wait, that's science fiction. How does that relate to your particular lives? But I think at the end of the day, they were just very, very hungry for information. And I think, you know, the subtext here is that it was somewhat demoralizing for some of them to recognize that the rest of the world, you know, at least the way they saw it, you know, on TV, the way the world is presented, the rest of the world was living in a particular way that made them feel slow and behind. And, you know, in some cases, you know, not, you know, unfortunately not the right body type. So you saw this kind of, you know, if you connect the dots here, you see that there's this, you know, new exposure, and it's very exciting because they're already feeling the pressure to be successful in a new economy. They don't have good role models. They find what they think might be a good role model on TV, but they sometimes confuse, you know, sort of what that person looks like for why that person is successful. And there it goes from there.
If I remember correctly, their desire to look like Kelly, for example. And for those who don't remember the character Kelly's 90210, blonde, living in a smaller body in a very affluent neighborhood, like you mentioned, Dr. Becker. Their desire to look like Kelly had more to do with achieving a certain status. Is that right? Because their culture was operating off of an ascribed status?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Thank you for making that really important point. And actually, let me, you know, add a little bit to that. So in anthropology, there, you know, we have lots of jargon, and one of the jargon words we use is ascribed versus achieved status. Mm. And in Fiji, there is something like a caste system where it's very hierarchical. And at the very top of the caste is the chiefly status. And then, you know, there are, you know, other sort of in intermediary individuals. But most people are, you know, they don't use this word, but commoners is kind of how you might think of it. And you are what you're born to, at least traditionally. And there aren't those opportunities. So if somebody is born into a chiefly household, that person is going to have privilege and opportunities that others might not have. And you know, and again, a long set of stories, you know, that could illustrate this, but there were, you know, poignant stories from people who talked about really wanting to be educated or wanting to transcend their status, and then feeling like there was too much, that was too much of a social taboo, and feeling too much pushback from others. But in this particular instance with television, one of the sort of new ideas that television brought was that many of these characters on TV were in control of their own life trajectory. They were making decisions. They were, in fact, this was commented on too. Wow, they get to, you know, decide how to cut their hair and, you know, all these things that, again, someone in the United States might take for granted as sort of mundane everyday decisions you were allowed to make. In Fiji, this was really extraordinary. And so, in a very positive way, the young women felt empowered. That, mm-hmm. oh, well, you know, people do it elsewhere. Maybe I should think about doing this. And you can just imagine how much tension then, you know, could arise in a situation like that, where you have these very kind of, you know, very, very established traditions where people don't transcend who they are. They don't make choices about how they present themselves. And you have this whole generation who is consuming media, mm-hmm. which is coming, you know, from, you know, and most of the media that was available in 1995 through 8 was generally imported from the US, the UK, New Zealand, Australia. There's very, very little local programming. And so the ideas really were coming. They were being out, you know, they were being sourced from far, far away. And yeah, so this was all part of the cauldron, if you will, yeah. where TV and, you know, I hate to use the word ambition because sometimes it's got a negative valence, but aspiration. Mm-hmm. These are young people who, you know, and plus they were trying to figure it out. I mean, they knew that Fiji was transitioning out of a subsistence agricultural way of life. And of course they wanted to participate successfully. So this is all going on at the same time as they are getting these ideas from TV.
And it's so interesting to think of a subsistence agriculture where you eat what you grow. The prized body would be robust and round and strong. Can you say more about why that would be?
Yeah. So another really excellent question. So in the local context there, if we set aside food for a moment and think about what, you know, where are the values centered in this Fijian community, it's really all about social health, social well-being, how is the community working together and supporting one another? And the size or, you know, strength or health of any individual body is often viewed as a proxy for, is the community taking care of this mm-hmm. individual well? And if not, why not? And how can it be corrected? And So in this society, at least traditionally, the way that communities demonstrate esteem for a community that, you know, maybe they want to create a relationship with or they have a relationship with is often through many, many ceremonies that establish relationships, but they're always accompanied by food exchange and food presentation. And there's a certain kind of code of etiquette that goes with these presentations that, you know, relevant or relative to local context, the foods that are highly prized, hard to get maybe, or especially mm-hmm. beautiful or large, that's the way you show your esteem for your guest or for your host or whatever it is. And so there's a certain equation of food size and food value with social value. And this, not surprisingly, gets tied up in how people's bodies look. So oftentimes it is expected that the chief of a village be rather large, and that would convey that the community is really taking good care of the chief. Same with children. Children should be well fed, and that, you know, shows that the community is doing its work. And also guests. So guests who are traveling in, they are sort of singled out for extraordinary care and feeding. And I definitely experienced that.
I remember that from my CD. I definitely remember. It's so interesting because it breaks my brain to think about how in our modern Western culture, we take these preferences that we have, say for smaller bodies or taller men or whatever the preferences are. It feels to us like they are so inherent, when in reality, it's conditioning. It's not inherent.
Well, I agree with you. And remember, this was part of my struggle. I couldn't get my head around the idea that, no, this was the preferred aesthetic ideal. It took me a while to accept that. But then I could not, for the longest time, fathom how it was that people didn't want to achieve that ideal, right? It just, you know, and people were like, yeah, that's beautiful, but why should I be bothered trying to look that way or be that way? That's for other people, right? Your body reflects how other people have behaved and cared for you, not kind of what your own, attributes are. So yeah, so it's very much socialized.
Very much socialized. And it's just a good reminder, not inherent, learned. Dr. Becker, can you explain why in Fiji, eating as much as possible is normal and not problematic, whereas in modern culture and certainly Western culture, it's pathology?
Sure. Yeah. And well, I'll certainly relate it to the context, which is that remember, you know, from the very earliest memory when children are fed and right through adulthood, they're socialized to feel very positively about being encouraged to eat more and being praised for eating more. So, so there's, you know, I would be so curious to watch a mealtime unfold because people would, you know, if they were, if, first of all, in Fiji, if you're serving a meal, the windows are open, the doors are open, everybody's encouraged to come in because your job is to basically send the signal that you want to feed everybody. You are there, you are able to feed everybody, and everybody is welcome. And when people do come in, they're, you know, they're coached into eating as much as possible. In fact, they're heckled if they don't, right? It gets to this point where it's a little uncomfortable and people are like, no, really, I'm really full. But the sense of eating maybe past satiety is then associated with a sense of feeling very valued and respected, mm-hmm. cared for. So it's, you know, it's not sort of a sense of, oh, whoops, I shouldn't have done that, which is, you know, which is something we should give careful thought to, right? How do we socialize individuals into enjoying their food and, you know, enjoying the experience of eating and also all that goes with it as a social experience?
In mid-1995, I believe, I thought that I saw somewhere that it was an average of maybe 3 hours a week of television watching. And like you said, it was communal.
It was, well, there was only TV aired for 6 hours a day, actually, you know, in the evening. So it wasn't somebody could just
and
watch them.
So fast forward today to 2023, where the average teenager is on social media or media of any kind for about 6 to 9 hours a day. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I have lots of thoughts, no data myself, but you're asking the right question, right? Because it's not, you know, we often talk about screen time, but it's not about the time. Well, that's relevant too for other reasons, physical activity, et cetera. But, you know, the question to me is, how do young people interact with ideas and communities? Mm-hmm. And it's not just the images they interact with. It's the values. It's the social norms they're interacting with. And, you know, my impression, and again, others are expert on this, I'm not. My impression is that social norms get kind of developed, ratified, clarified very quickly in these kind of smaller communities, right, where people find their people and, you know, among their followers, you know, other people would use the term echo chamber, right? So you get to sort of find your people and establish what is normative, and then everybody feels comfortable following the rules that they essentially made up, I guess. But in, you know, I think it's important, if we just take a step back, just say a quick word about the follow-up study we did in Fiji. Now, this was pre-social media, more or less. It was 2007 in Fiji. But we did want to go back and unpack what about media maybe was driving symptoms. And so just, you know, very, very briefly, this study, the second follow-up study, was representative. We went to an entire region of Fiji, and we chose the region because they all spoke the same dialect. And we went to every single school that was registered by the Ministry of Education in that area, and they had a wonderful collaborator from the Ministry of Education, Asanatha Bainivoliku, and we worked with the principals to enroll or offer enrollment to every single student, you know, within a certain age range in that area. So it could be a really truly representative sample and a large sample. So we had 523 respondents this time, and we offered questionnaires in the local dialect or English, whatever people preferred. But the key finding from this study, because this time around we were, you know, we want to understand, is it exposure to McDonald's? Is it exposure to a relative coming back from overseas, et cetera? Or is it TV? And how is it TV? And is it the way TV is consumed? But I'll cut to the chase here. what we found when we looked at media exposure and its relationship to eating pathology is that it was the exposure from a social network, I'm distinguishing it from social media here, social network, meaning your peers, your schoolmates, what those individuals were doing, whether those people were living in households that had TVs and were exposed. And so what does that mean? That means that you don't have to be the person sitting in front of the TV to be the person who is affected by the TV, right? So it's not just about the images. It's about the ideas that get circulated and reinforced and ratified in this community. And for that reason, that's where I would really be worried about the impacts of social media. I mean, they could be positive impacts, I'm sure.
It's so powerful what you just said. You don't have to be the person sitting in front of the TV to be the person who's affected by the TV. So Dr. Becker, I want to ask you, what is something that you're creating right now that you're excited about?
Well, I like many of the listeners, my life is a little bit disrupted by the pandemic. So I haven't been in the field recently. And I will tell you actually that in March 2020, if you dial back and remember what was happening then, I had a ticket, as did my collaborator, David Angelson, to begin a new project in Kiribati. Kiribati is very close to Fiji in the Pacific Islands. And David was actually on his flight from Auckland to Tarawa and connected through Fiji. And when he connected, they said, "We're so sorry, the country is now closed."
Oh my gosh.
So talk about disruptive. It shouldn't be about us in our study, of course. It was very disruptive to this country. But that's to say that we were so excited about a project that we were embarking on there with collaborators there. And then, you know, things got a bit derailed. But I will say, why am I excited about this, the set of ideas, is that we are very interested in understanding and kind of elevating the visibility of how food insecurity and degradation of the food environment, in particular in the setting of climate change impacts and sometimes forced migration, we're very interested in understanding how that impacts young people. You know, of course, there's a lot of discussion about how climate change concerns and realities impacts mental health in kind of a global way. But we are also very concerned about how that combination with food insecurity, and also, you know, that, you know, as you can imagine, you know, when people are contemplating migration, they're contemplating how they're going to fit in and how they're going to be, you know, successful in a new economy. And so we're very concerned about that, and also, you know, wanting to understand, you know, in the same way as one understands, one can think about intervention. So that's what is on my mind now. David has been working with this community in Kiribati, and with a colleague, Rose Namori Sinclair. This is their project. They've done some wonderful work, not on this particular topic about eating disorders, but just kind of on the impacts of climate change and this Kiribati community, and, you know, how they're experiencing the migration. And what I have learned from my colleague Rose is how important it is for us to really center the voices of the community. And, you know, we are, you know, this is true of all kinds of evidence gathering, but we're used to going in with a hypothesis and an agenda that is based on our own experience and our own needs and priorities. And of course, we always want to listen to what's going on locally, but it is clear we really need to center the voices of the community. And that's what I'm excited about. I'm excited about supporting that in any way that I can.
I want to thank you, Dr. Becker, for taking the time to be here today. I have included your work in so many talks and presentations, and uses a tool to teach about culture, body image, and food. And I just want to thank you for putting such groundbreaking work out there back then and now.
Well, it's very kind of you to say that. And I have to say that in speaking about it, I feel very energized to think about taking the work forward. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And as a reminder, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. See you next month.